Boom, we're on. Today's guest, we've got five-time Mr. Universe, Eddie Elwood. How are you, brother?
Three times England's strongest man.
And three times England's strongest man. How are you, brother?
I'm good, thanks.
It's good to have you on.
Cheers for getting me on, James.
Phenomenal career. So as to winning Mr. Universe five times, competing against the biggest names on the planet, England's strongman as well. You went from Mr. Universe to then going strongman,
yep,
which is not many people can do. But phenomenal achievements, and it's an absolute honour to sit across for you, brother.
Thank you very much.
First of all, how are you?
Pardon?
How are you?
How?
How's things?
Sorry about Scottish that. Yes, the Scottish. How's things? I'm very, very good, thank you.
Yeah, keeping busy.
I'm keeping busy. The whole COVID thing's kept me busy. My life is just living as normal. I'm not a person who would go drinking anyway, so I haven't missed the pubs. Maybe just missed a couple of restaurants, that's about it.
Yeah. We'll touch on all that stuff. I know you went to court and stuff. You were one of the few who kept our gym open to try and help people with their mental health and stuff, and they kept trying to shut you down. But I'll always go back to the start of my guests.
That's fine.
Where you grew up and how it all began.
I started, I lived in Horden, which is a close village to here. It was a mining village before all the mines were closed by the Tories. And that was an era as well, you know, where everybody was living from day to day. You know, they were living off food parcels. But I was a young kid, very adventurous. We had local beaches, local forests and stuff. A lot of the stuff I did on my own, you know, I would go out to the forest, I'd go out to the beach, maybe me and one or two other friends, but I was always out. I was always doing something. My father learned me the fundamentals of boxing at a very young age. And at the age of 12, I got my medical card to start boxing. I had 56 amateur fights. And finished my amateur career at the age of 19. I boxed a guy who you've had on recently, Richie Horsley.
Great guy, shout out to Richie.
And I still keep in touch with Richie. You know, he pops in the gym every now and again. We've been friends a long time. I boxed in the culmination of it was when I was 19, I was boxing at light heavyweight. And I was looking forward to boxing in the area ABAs at light heavyweight. And I'd gone to weigh in. There was only 10 minutes left of the weigh in. We got there. I weighed in 2 pounds over the light heavyweight limit. I was about 12 stone 10. And they said, "Yeah, you need to lose 2 pounds. I didn't have time to lose 2 pounds. My coach said, "Just fight heavyweight." But I was like, it's a lot of weight to give away when you're only 12 stone 10, like up to 13 stone 4, you know. 14 stone 4 at the time. And I was like, right, okay then. So I boxed two brothers, one in the quarterfinal and the other one in the
semi-final.
And the brothers were called Tony and Peter Hallett from Newcastle. The father was called Paddy Hallett. He was their coach. And they were both 6'3", 6'4" lads, you know, tall, like gangly lads, but they were heavyweights, you know. And I beat both of them to box in the area final. And I boxed a guy called Manny Burgo in the area final. Really, I was only a light heavyweight. Manny looked the part. He'd boxed for England. He had his England vest on. Lovely lad, Manny. Lives at North Shields. And I got beat to Manny on a majority, which is 2-1. So Manny says to us, "I think you're getting it," but like, it was only because I boxed. I didn't try to mix it with him. I didn't have the body weight to mix it with him. So I came away from that fight thinking, at the age of 19, I'm going to become a real heavyweight. So I need to chase that on. My father had always been into weight training and run weight training gyms. I'd always been a very parky eater. I just ate what I want, you know. And I was like, if my mum gives a steak, I used to twist, you know. And I suppose I should have thought myself a bit lucky, but I was like, I would rather have beans on toast, you know, egg and chips. But at the time, I knew I would have to start eating properly. I would have to start doing everything right. So I listened to what my dad had to say. He says, "Right, why don't you train for this bodybuilding show," which was 6 months' time, which would really get us in the mind play to eat good food, to get lean and put good tissue on for the bodybuilding competition, which was in October. I finished in the main boxing, so I trained for the bodybuilding show in October. I went from 12 stone 10, you know, not totally lean, but I was like, you know, I was somewhere near. But I ended up getting on a bodybuilding show for a junior competition at the age of 19 in the October at 13 stone 4, but ripped. And I won it. So I thought, oh, this is all right. I think I might do another one because I'm 13 stone 4 was still not heavy enough for us. I wanted to get a bit heavier. So I set myself another goal for to do the area qualify for the Britain finals as a junior. And the federation I was competing in is called NABBA, National Amateur Bodybuilding Association. And it was the biggest competition in the country at the time to get ready for the Mr. Britain. So I got ready for the North Britain as a junior, and the junior stipulation was to be under 20 on January the 1st, which I was, because I didn't turn 21 in the March. So, sorry, I was 20 when I did the first one. So I was 21 in the March. So I was 20 on January the 1st. So the show was in the April. So I was 21. But somebody had been spreading a rumor that I was too old. So when I got the, but I didn't know this. When I got the competition, the judges said, oh, have you got your birth certificate? Are you driving license? I've been told you're too old. I said, I'm not too old. I'm 21. You know what I mean? Well, if you haven't got proof of ID, you're going to have to do the novices. Well, it broke me out because it was only my second competition and I wanted to go and win a junior title, you know. Novices was a step up, was more senior. Anyway, I did the novices, qualified for the Britain, and I still placed fifth in a good line out at the Britain finals. But that chased me straight into the Mr. category. So within less than a year of training, I was already a Mr. category bodybuilder. I needed to put some tissue on. I was 6 foot one and a half, you know, and I was only 14 stone four at the second competition. So then I got ready for the similar show I'd done as a junior the previous year to do in the October as a Mr. It was called the Mr. British Isles, and I won that competition as a Mr. A year later. And then I lost all interest in the boxing. I just carried on with the bodybuilding, and away I went.
It's totally night and day. How was your dad a competitor?
My dad wasn't a competitor. He's more just a coach. You know, he'd not studied, but he knew the basics. Mm-hmm. You know, he knew the basic fundamentals of how to train, how to eat. So he got me on, he started me on the right path. But then I started researching, like if I'm going to do anything, I want to do it properly, and I research and I put my time and effort into it. And I went from strength to strength. So in 84, I did the novice. 85, I did my first tall class Britain finals. So from the previous year, getting fifth in the novice, a year later, I got fifth in the tall class Mister. A year after that, I won the tall class Mister. It was 87, I won the tall class Mister. 88, sorry, second in the tall class Mister. Second in the tall class Mister. 88, I won the tall class Mister. I came back in 89 and I won the overall. So that's the four classes put together. So I won my class and the overall in 89.
What was the controversy? Was it you were 19, 20 and they tried to kick you out?
What happened was I was amateur and I always used to take a great big following to Blackpool. It was a great time for bodybuilding, the 80s, early 90s. And I used to have like probably two 30, 40 seater busloads. We sell 90 to 150 tickets to go to Blackpool. People used to go in the cars. We used to book boarding houses, you know, we used to spend a weekend there. But it was a great camaraderie and a great weekend. And my father had took on the role as a WABA president for the Northeast, and the federation I was competing with was NABBA, National Amateur Bodybuilding, where my dad had took all of the World Amateur Bodybuilding Federation area representative. So I think NABBA were worried about me taking my support all the way over there. I'd already qualified for the Britain as a Mister in 89 when they came in and said, I don't know how it came about, but I was the first person to be banned by the National Amateur Bodybuilding Association. So they sent me a ban. And I was like, when I received it, I was shocked because there'd always been a very, very fair federation. I was thinking, well, where's this come from? It was because I'd done a guest appearance at another bodybuilding show. It was only guest appearance. I wasn't competing. I wasn't a professional. I didn't have any contracts with this federation. And I thought, nah, again, standing up to the bullies, you know, that's the most important lesson I've ever learned by my father is always stand up for yourself. Never bully anybody, but always, you know what I mean, always stand up for yourself if anybody tries to bully you. So I decided, no, I'm taking this to court. So I found a bar. I was unemployed at the time, so I got illegal aid, and I found a barrister in a sports solicitor in Leeds that would take the case on. Went down to see him a couple of times, which was an hour and a half's travel each time. Went to see him, and ended up in Crown Court. But it didn't end up in Crown Court till the eve of the Britain. So I had to train to get ready for a competition I didn't even know whether I was going to be allowed to compete in. So I trained and dieted my ass off to get ready for this competition. And just before the competition, we got to know that it was on the eve of the Britain finals, which was the Friday, which would be a day we'd normally travel over to Blackpool, you know, and settle up. So the buses had to wait for us coming back from the courts. So we went down to the courts and went in the courts, and NABBA hadn't sent nobody to represent themselves. So straight away, the judge ordered that I'd be given an injunction to compete. They haven't bothered, you know, it's affecting your career. They haven't bothered to turn up to defend themselves. So I'm going to send somebody over tonight to Blackpool and give an injunction to all the committee members that have banned you. So you will get your chance to compete tomorrow, he said. So we left there, drove back to the gym, and we didn't want no time for Facebook or mobile phones even, you know, so that we couldn't even let them know that I'd get me injunction. So when we got back, they all erupted on the buses, you know, they were like over the moon that we were competing, but none of the officials knew why. They were getting served there on the night. So we were all happy driving over towards Blackpool in our buses, settled up in the boarding houses, went out for a light walk, a couple of little wines, you know, the night before. The rest of them partied. I got up to go at the venue the next day. Sorry, on the evening time, we were relaxing the boarding houses. The guy who had been sent over to serve the injunctions had come to board and I said, I'm sorry, I've tried to serve these, nobody will accept them. Nobody's admitting to be Ivan Dunbar or certain names, you know. John Clements was a guy who was the Scottish representative. And so my brother said, well, I'll come along, I'll point them all out. So he went along, pointed them all out, and they all got served the injunction for me to compete the next day. So I suppose it was a bit of a shock for them. So the next day I was all full of myself, you know, like really like chest pumped up, you know, just walked down the new tracksuit on, walked down the none of the other competitors would have even known I was there, you know. So I suppose they were all shocked too, because I was somebody who was climbing at the time, so I would have been a threat to a lot of people, yeah. You know. So that,
were you a favourite or anything at that time?
I was somewhere near, yeah, because I'd won the tall class the year before, so they must have all a bit, and because I was improving every year, they'll be thinking, because you didn't have social media like this, so you couldn't post what you were doing, not that I wanted to, I always kept covered up, but when I got there, I was probably 10 pounds heavier than the previous year, so nobody knew that, and I was in good nick. So I walked into the Winter Gardens on the morning and John Clements spotted us, but he hadn't known about the injunction. So John Clements, the Scottish rep, came over and he was a friend. You know, he says, all right, Eddie, how you doing? And he looked at us strange because I had my bodybuilding tan on, you know. He looked, he went, what are you doing here? I says, I'm competing. And he looked shocked. He went, yeah. Oh, but you're not. And he just stormed off. So I was like grinning inside, really thinking like somebody else shocked, you know. So I went and sat in the audience. We always used to just, I checked in, the loudest to check in, went and sat in the audience. And halfway through the afternoon, it was probably about 2 hours before I was due on stage, as I was just watching the rest of the judging, I got a call out from Tony Sullivan, God rest his soul, he's passed away now, but he became a personal friend. But at the time, I wasn't his friend, you know, so I got a call out from Tony Sullivan, who was then the NABBA chairman. Could Eddie Elwood please come backstage? So I wandered backstage. And Tony said, he says, you're not competing today. I said, I beg your pardon. He says, we've just received an injunction to stop you competing today, to overrule your injunction from the High Court in London by Judge Papadopoulos. And I was thinking, what? I even remember the name because it's so pathetic, you know, Judge Papadopoulos of the High Court London. I went to serve it then. He was like, no, we don't have to. I said, you do. I said, you've got to serve an injunction for it to have effect. He says, no. I said, you do. I said, you don't serve me an injunction, I'm getting on that stage. I even had it in my head anyway that there was some toilets out the back, like down at the Winter Garden, and went down some stairs, which I'd used over the previous years. And I thought, I'll get changed down there. Even if they don't allow us to compete, I'll get changed down there. I'll be in the hall and I'll jump on the stage when my class is on, hit a few shots, and I'll wait just to let them know I was there. Mm-hmm. And let the audience know I was prepared, you know what I mean? So that was the final outcome, if that's where it was going to be. But anyway, I came back out. They didn't serve as an injunction. I came back out, sat in the audience again. About half an hour later, could Eddie Elwood please come backstage? So I says to my dad, will you come with us to witness this? You know, so I went back. Again, started saying, I says, I'm getting on the stage. You're not serving me an injunction. I'm competing. I was always worried because I always thought, like, because I'm really putting a fight up, I'm not going to get judged fairly. Mm-hmm. But what I know now, because I became like a top official of NABBA now, I'm like international NABBA president now, world president. So what ranks I've gone through from area representative to NABBA chairman and everything else, mm-hmm. I know there's no skullduggery goes on.
So not working together?
So they're not working together. What happens? I actually put things in place to stop any sort of bias and, mm-hmm. and bad judgment. Because at one time, judges used to be just friends of friends, but they weren't representatives, they weren't the actual committee. They were judges from areas, you know, like just bodybuilders that were from certain areas. Like, you had to have a judging panel in your area, so they would pick bodybuilders from that area. Mm-hmm. So the judges, the area representatives weren't the ones judging. Yeah.
So what makes a good judge then?
So I actually, what I do now is I actually judge the judges. So I have a score system where the final outcome is judged on 9 judges. So there's 9 judges give their scores from 8 down through 1. So if there's 20 competitors on stage, they've got to judge 8 to 1. So that's 8th to 1st. And out of that 8th to 1st, if you've got 9 decent judges, you should get the top 6. You know, mm-hmm. you say, well, you should get the top 6. They should get in them 8. You should get somewhere near your top 6. And there's a foot, like you say, the 6-8 points down to 1 point. So the less points you have is higher up you are. So to remove any bias, you've got 9 judges. Each judge has his highest and his lowest point on a page taken out. You understand where I'm going? So not each judge, each category mm-hmm. has the highest and the lowest. So if there's a judge being biased and judging somebody down, that's removed. If there's a judge being biased and judging somebody up, that's removed. So you're not getting any favoritism. Mm-hmm. So then you get an average of points at the end. So the judge on 7 judges, really. Each class is judged on 7 judges because 2 judges are removed out of each class. And then the points are added up and total. So then I can work out which judge has been the closest to the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, right down to 8th place. So I'll give a judge, now the scoring system says, it gives each judge points on each placing. So if you get a placing correct, so it's the first, your first match is the first at the end, you get 3 points. If you're first, if you're, you've got somebody second that's first, you get 2 points because it's 1 place removed. And if you've got a place 3 removed, so you've got the 1st in 3rd, you only get 1 point, mm-hmm. and you don't get any points for any places that's outside of 3. So then points are added up. So each judge has added score mm-hmm. points up, and it works out that you can find the best judge, you know?
So there's no politics behind that.
So there's no politics. No. So now when judges get sent from areas to judge your nationals, it's the best judges in each area, mm-hmm. and you monitor it, you know? You can't be biased. You can't just send your friend. Somebody you might not want to send, but you have to send because he's won. You know, he's mm-hmm. the best judge.
So what happens with the injunction then? Did you get to compete?
So I got to compete. So this is what I'm telling you now. The 9 judges, I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to get shoved up my backside. But I was spot on. I had to be spot on that year. Anyway, I got on stage, competed, came off stage, and I was surprised that so many judges would come to us and say, I'm glad you were on form today, you've getting it. As far as I'm concerned, I judge you first. You know what I mean? I was thinking, like, what? And then I realised these are all just bodybuilders, and they were quite proud of what I'd done, standing up for myself, you know what I mean, in that type of situation. And my mum still got the score sheet out of the 9 judges, on 9 firsts. It was like a unanimous point.
So you won it.
So I won it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Nobody can dispute that, you know? And then after that competition, I got a phone call off one of the representatives. So he would be, you know, not in favour of us. And he rang us at the gym and he said, you were never, ever going to do anything with NABBA again. That was a phone call he made to me. And I was thinking, like, it's time to go IFBB anyway, which is the Mr. Olympia circuit, to try and get me professional card to compete on the Olympia circuit. So I went from winning the NABBA show that year, within a few months I'd done the IFBB finals and got third. So I didn't win their show, I got third. And then I came back the following year, messed up with me diet a little bit, and ended up in second place. Because every year they only give two pro cards out. It's not like nowadays, everybody's a pro. You know what I mean? They're not pros, but you know, they call themselves pros. Yeah. It's a joke, it is a joke. And it's a it's a money-making system. You know what I mean? There's, I think they give about 300 pro cards out in the country every year. So each one of them has to pay £200 or £300 professional card money. So it's a money-making racket now, where back in my day, they give one to the overall mister, one to the overall miss. You got two, the men's something. So nationally, there's two pro cards given out. So it took me 3 years to get my pro card. So I got my pro card in the October of 91.
How old were you?
20. I can't really remember. 91, how old would I been? About 27, 28.
Can I not be disheartening, though, that if you're competing and try to train hard and eat right and sacrifice for people not wanting you in their competition? Or was it a fuck you to them? So I'm going to show you.
Yes, well, this is where I'm getting with the IFBB. IFBB is very political, and they've never really favoured any of the NABBA guys coming across.
Why is that?
Because they want to show that, because NABBA was the biggest federation at one time, and they don't want, this is my opinion, and it's probably a lot of people's opinion, that, I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger won four Mr. Universe titles. I think it was two amateur and two professionals. Eduardo Cauac from France, he won four Mr. Universe titles off the trot. Actually, no, he won five Universe titles like me, but they weren't all consecutive. I'm the only one that's won five consecutive titles. So I broke a record, and it'll stand for a long time because the money's not there. But anyway, any time... anybody left, but obviously in the day of Arnold, there wasn't that many competitors. So the Weeders came across, did the Universe, took that model back to the US. They even stole the trophy. You know, the Sandow trophy, what they now give out is the Olympia trophy, was the original Universe trophy. So now they've got the monopoly on giving that trophy out. Arnold was... really contracted to go in the early days because he was trying to steal all the NABBA guys, all the top NABBA guys, to make his show work in the US. And that's how it got lifted with the likes of Arnold and, you know, so all them made the IFBB strong. But then in the future, any most NABBA guys that were going across were getting knocked back. You know, they were like, they weren't making it big. All the Americans were, like, any English or whatever. But since then, I mean, anybody who competes just IFBB, who's just gone through the ranks of IFBB, always earn the stripes, you know. Not that they haven't deserved it, but you can, like, be on form when, like, as a NABBA competitor and go to IFBB and not make it.
What was your training like, and how was your calorie intake?
Crazy.
Did that go up every year?
Being at the body weight, what I was a big 6'1", and in my final year of competition, I competed on stage at 20.5 stone ripped. And to maintain that type of muscularity at that body weight, it took a lot of heavy training and a lot of calorific eating. I used to consume, and like, I can't get this today, like, everybody's eating no carbs, you know, lots of protein, no carbs, and peanut butter. I don't know where it comes from. I really don't know where it comes from. You know, high fats. Because I kept a balanced diet, but my carbohydrate intake was like high compared to today. I would do 700 to 800 grams of carbs daily. But if you're training that intensely, you need them. I mean, cyclists, women's cyclists team in one of the Olympics was consuming 8,000 calories a day. If you're exercising, you need it. You start reducing your calories that much, you'll just lose muscle tissue, your body metabolism will slow down, and you'll you look like a bag of crap, really.
Yeah. So do you think you're consuming over 10,000 calories a day?
I wouldn't have said 10,000, Arthur. I would have said probably 5 or 6 quality calories, mm-hmm. but you needed the quality calories to gain.
How was your energy levels?
Energy levels were good apart from competing, because then you start cutting calories. Like, my bodybuilding diet was the same, probably, well, it was the same. The bodybuilding diet remained the same constantly, but if I was off season, I wasn't competing, if I wanted a pizza, a burger, or a Chinese, they were as well as. So I got my excess calories and my cravings were killed by utilizing the junk, mm-hmm. as well as.
What was your cut like before a competition cutting?
Would you break my calories up? Yeah. Well, like I said, like I was only eating excess calories by eating on top of my normal bodybuilding diet. So I would get rid of the pizza, the you know, and my diet would be just back to normal, you know, because I was eating them foods every day anyway. I didn't do oats. I didn't do wheat, because wheat binds to estrogen, and when you're taking levels of synthetic hormone, then your natural estrogen levels rise in ratio. So if you take some synthetic male hormone, your natural estrogen levels rise in ratio, because men have female hormone, mm-hmm. and your body reacts. So usually your synthetic hormone, when you finish taking it, drops very quickly, but your estrogen level being natural won't, so it becomes imbalanced.
Yeah. So what happens when your estrogen goes up? Do you get more emotional?
Estrogen levels are high, you get like...
depressed, emotions?
Well, as such as that, you get female characteristics, which they call bitch tit. Mm-hmm. Water retention, you know, like, you know, a woman, yeah, you get moody. I better be careful what I say. But you know what I'm saying, like the wrong time of the month, a woman carries water, and that's because the estrogen levels are higher. And the same within men. And I used to cut out gluten, because gluten used to bind estrogen. So removing the gluten out your body would stop would limit the amount of estrogen that was getting held. And it used to work, going gluten-free.
Did you study all this? Did you read books or anything beforehand?
Always. I was always on the hunt to make sure that I was a step ahead of everybody else. Mm-hmm. Always.
Did people want to train with you, or did you train yourself?
I could train myself, but I would always have a training partner for timing, because I didn't need anybody for push. I could do it myself. I just needed training partners for timing and a little bit of assistance. So the minute I was off, they were down. The minute they were off, I was down. And that's the way I trained always, which stood us in good stead for me strongman, because like the strongman fitness had to be there as well. So lifting weight and carrying weight and back and forth, you needed good heart and lungs as well as grip. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd never trained with any strongman equipment when I got into strongman, but like I was always fit, you know.
When you won Mr. Universe in 96, what was that feeling like? Were you going in?
I didn't win it in 96. 97? What happened was, I'd done IFBB for 4 years, and I felt like when I got my IFBB Pro card, the first show I did was the 92 Arnold Classic. Mm. And it was the biggest show. It was bigger than the Olympia, really, for prize money. It was as big as prize money, and with having Arnold's name behind it, it was like massive. But we only had 20 competitors every year, and you had to get an invite. Well, I came in the back door, really, because I was doing a show on Ireland, just after getting my pro card, and a woman called Diane Bennett, who was the daughter of Wag Bennett, had noticed. She says, well, why don't you do the Arnold Classic? I said, I'm not getting an invite. I haven't done a pro show yet. You know, she said, I'll get you an invite. Well, she'd been to Arnold's wedding and everything, because when Arnold came to the country in the early days, he used to stay with Diane and Wag, so the good friends of the family. And Diane, I went down to see her. She says, do you want to see the pictures of the wedding? She says, I was the only one that was allowed a camera at Arnold's wedding. She says, because he didn't want anybody else selling prints, and he knew he could trust me to just take me on pictures and keep mm-hmm. them. So she had her own family album of Arnold's wedding. She showed us them. So I knew she was well in with Arnold. Yeah. Anyway, Arnold getting she said, oh, you just need to ring Jim Lorimer, who was Arnold's partner at the time. So I rang Jim Lorimer, sorted it all out, got in, and I'm thinking, I can't believe I'm doing the Arnold Classic for my first pro show. Anyway, went to the States, got well treated at the Arnold Classic. He really looked after you, you know. And I'm not saying I deserve to win any of the IFBB shows. And it was like, see, I was a rookie when I went across to do the Arnold Classic. So I was in good condition. and came off stage a bit deflated because I didn't get many call outs or anything. And so I thought, well, just maybe it's just because I'm new. Anyway, I came home from that, and I always funded myself, really, apart from like the one that you did get some shows, like the Arnold Classic was invites, so you got your hotel and everything paid. But usually I'd fund myself just because I wanted to be Sean Keane. I came back from there, and I was in my father's gym training, and the phone rang, and it was Wayne D'Amelio, who ran the Federation for the Weeders. And he got on the phone, he says, Eddie, he says, you'll never do nothing with IFBB because you've got no arms. And I did have a problem with my arms. I wasn't disputing that. Because of all my boxing training over the years, my fast work, it's like a sprinter's never going to build a pair of legs like Tom Platz. You know, sorry, a long distance runner's never going to build a pair of legs, you know, because they've trained the muscle fibers a different way. So I pounded my arms in different routines to try and make them grow. Eventually, I did get them, but not as big to match the rest of my physique. So my arms were a little touch like, but that's not the attitude he should have had. Me being a rookie, I felt as you should have gotten on the phone and said, listen, Eddie, you know, you looked okay, but your arms are weak. You know, you need to get your arms up if you're going to do anything. And that wasn't the attitude he had with me. Mm-hmm. You know, he just basically shot me down.
Is that deflating you?
It did deflate me at the time because I got off the phone and I said to my dad, he doesn't like me, him. You know, when you get that feeling from somebody, just, well, off that type of phone call, what would you feel, you know?
Yeah.
When somebody's telling you you're not going to do anything. And then I thought, well, why is he saying that? I was trying to dissect it all, you know? I was thinking, well, why has he said it? What's behind it? Is it because I've gone through Diane and not the right channels? Mm. So I thought, no, but I'll come home, I'll work hard, and I'll go back and I'll show them that and improve, you know? And that's what I kept doing, year in, year out, still getting squashed every time, you know what I mean? His show was in the May, the New York Night of the Champions, and it was his show, and I thought, you know something, I'll pay to go and do, like a lot of competitors got paid to go and do his show. I thought, I'll ask him if I can do his show, and I'll pay me expenses to go. He'll say I'm keen, you know what I mean? I went, nah, it was a waste of money, you know?
Yeah.
There was 35 competitors on stage. Three rows, the stage was only short, so they couldn't get 35 across the stage. So they had three rows, they had like a 2 12s and an 11. And I happened to be on the third row back in the far corner near the curtain. And I was thinking, oh, they should start rotating the rows. Can we now have the second row to the front and the first row to the back? And I was expecting to move on to the front. Didn't happen like that. They just shout people out that they knew. So I'm stood here at the back of the curtain just deflating, you know, I lost it. And I lost a bit of motivation a little bit. So for 4 years I was doing this. And I was doing the English Grand Prix every year. The English Grand Prix was the biggest IFBB show in the country, professional show. And I was doing it only to show the English supporters that I was getting it shoved up my ass, you know, because I was big enough. I was good enough to place, not saying win, to place top 10 and not getting top 15, sometimes in the top 20. So the last year I did it, I got myself as good as I could get, and I thought, and I said to my parents, because I'd been in there 4 years, not won a thing, after winning a Britain title and the EFBB British, I was the first person to win both the NABBA Britain and the EFBB overall titles. I was the only person at the time to have won both. And I thought, like, I've done this for 4 years and I've had no recognition whatsoever. And I'm like 4 years and I was like 32 or whatever. And I was thinking, like, I can't carry on doing this. It wasn't good energy. It was all negative. As much as I was trying my hardest, because of the situation, I was just feeling knocked back all the time. So, but I did put a lot of effort into the last one, and I just said, you know something, if I could win today, I'm still going back to NABBA. I want to finish my career off and try. Even though I felt as though I was just stepping down a grade, you know what I mean? I felt as though I can go there and I'm going to get judged fairly and I can get something out the latter years of my career. So I made that decision before I did my last IFBB English Grand Prix. In 96, I did the English Grand Prix and they give us a seventh, but seventh didn't qualify if we know Olympia, and it just kept you out the top six prize money. I think I deserved a fifth that year, you know what I mean? But wasn't to be. Anyway, I did the NABBA Universe about 3 or 4 weeks later. So I was coming from a different federation into there again. Yeah. And I got
did
fourth.
Did they accept you? Okay.
I was accepted, but I don't think I was accepted by all the judges. I got a fourth. I don't think I deserved the fourth. Thing second would have done that year. You know what I mean? I think, like, I'm quite critical of myself. You know what I mean? I'll see where I think I should have been. And I got second that year. Sorry, got fourth that year, and I think I deserved a second. So I thought, but I knew in my own mind it was positive enough to lift us. Mm-hmm. I got a lot of guest appearances from it, from NABBA shows. So I went around the country doing the NABBA shows guest appearances, and I just thought, I can win this show next year. Pulled me puddings out, won in 97. And I thought, well, what else have I got to do? I'll just carry on doing this.
What changed for then having that winner's mentality that you believe? Was it belief or was it?
It's always been belief.
Extra training, better diet. How did you then kick on?
It was a different federation. It's a different class.
But to finish fourth and then having that belief that you were going to win it and then going on winning it?
I just knew myself. I just, like, because I had been judged, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Even there was probably, I don't know, dozens or so professionals on stage at that competition. So for them not to stick it up my backside and give us outside top six, they'd give us outside top six because I'd actually gained a top six place in. It was a little bit of deflation, but then you accept it because you know you've just come back. And like some judges, like, and I don't think they're purposely being biased. I think it's like subliminal, you know what I mean? Oh, maybe he's not as good as the NABBA man, you know what I mean? I think it's a bit more, it's a bit more subliminal that they're thinking that their guys are better until you actually earn your weight, like their confidence in you.
What's it like with other competitors? There's a lot of jealousy, a lot of backstabbing, or has everybody got
You know something, back in my day in the 90s, I'll tell you a little story. When I won my IFBB pro card that year, it looked like I wasn't going to qualify. I actually went down to qualify at Nottingham. It was at the Commodore Theatre, and I got third at a qualifier, right? And I deserved the third, but the class of competition, there was a guy called Linky Wilson and another guy called Pete Chapman, who were class competitors, proper good professional looking heavyweights. And I got third to them, but I was still a good competitor. So I thought, look, qualify all three of us. No, they left me out. They qualified two and left me out. I came away from that because I wasn't on form. I just went to qualify. Yeah. You know, I thought I'll just get me qualified today and I'll hone in for the finals. Because I didn't get qualified, I came away. My father says, I think you burnt yourself out. I think you need to have a rest. I think you need to put some beef on for next year. Just you've done too many shows. Have a rest, you know what I mean? I went, no. I said, I'm going to do another qualifying, do the finals. I know, well, I'll take a lot out of you. I said, I'm doing it. I know I can get ready for the finals. So anyway, I did the Northeast qualify, which was 6 weeks later. I was the only one that turned up that qualified me. I was good enough though. So I qualified and then I got ready for the finals that year. And that year, the guy that beat me when I got a second in NABBA Britain in 88, Basil Francis competed. A lad called Linky Wilson, Pete Chapman, Wadley, JD, I don't know if he's JD or whatever. But Armory Francis, the line-out was amazing, right? So, like, it was good company. And Ian Wadley's shared it a few times on like, social media. When you watch it, you look at them all and you think, who's won this? It was that class of competition. I would not have argued if I'd gotten sixth in the top six. It was that good a competition. And I'll still say it today, nobody would have argued who, out of the six that were top six, if the sixth was first or if the fourth was first, nobody would argue it was that close.
What did judges look for?
Symmetry, balance, condition and mass. Yeah.
So when you came out, how many, like, pose, what other things have you got to do?
So really, you're looking at a symmetry round, which is basically you turn your body in four ways so they can pick out your weaknesses. So you basically just stood side on and they're going to look at your side to see if you've got depth, chest thickness, back thickness, you got no loose skin under your backside. You know, it's, I suppose, like judging a dog competition, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And they're not really poses, you just stood on. Then you turn from one side to the back, so you're showing your back to show the thickness in your back, your traps, your calves, your hamstrings. Then you turn the opposite side to make sure your opposite side is as good a balance as the other side. Then you show your front. So then they see whether your chest's hanging or full or, you know, they can pick out your weaknesses.
How many rounds?
There's only two rounds, really. So you do your quarter turns and you judge on your quarter turns, and then you go into your, you do your posing routine, which is not really marked. It's just basically for audience enjoyment.
So it's just about entertainment, because you've seen people coming out and body popping and dancing. Yeah, it kind of changed through the years.
I mean, sometimes they give a best routine. Sometimes they'll give a best routine award, but really it's more for entertainment. Mm-hmm. And then there's the compulsory round where you do your muscularity poses, which is a double bicep, your to the front, your lat spread where you pull your back out, your abdominals and thighs where you show your abdominals and thighs, your side tricep where you show your tricep, side chest where you show your chest. Then you turn face the rear and you do a double bicep from behind, show the muscularity in your back, and you do a lat spread from the back. You turn around, you do most muscular, which shows all the vascularity and the thickness that you're carrying. And you're marked on all that. And you have to have a balanced physique, so otherwise you're going to get picked straight away. You're going to the people, oh, he's got better calves than him. They're both about the same, but his calves are better than his, you know what I mean? Or he's got a torn bicep where he hasn't. You know, they can pick all them weaknesses out, so they're given chance to give you a good look over.
Yeah. So when you won your first Mr. Universe, what was that feeling like for you?
It was a lift because I hadn't won anything in 4 years. Mm-hmm. You know, well, 5 years actually, by the time I'd won my first Universe. It was a lift because I won it in the first one in 5 years. And then, it became it became a goal more than anything. The best competition I felt was the Mr. Britain win. Me nabbing Mr. Britain win in 1989.
Why?
I don't know. It was just, I think, because I'd been through so much with the court and everything. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Getting stopped competing. It just overwhelmed us. You know what I mean? You know, when you feel the hairs stand up on you, when you're in that situation where something makes you, it just rushes over you. Mm-hmm. I'm spiritual that way. And looking back, at the time, I felt as though I was having like an out-of-body experience, as if I was watching myself. Like, you know what I mean? It was just an amazing feeling. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing feeling.
So how do you end up going on in 1 in 5, Mr. Universe? How hard is that on the body? How much it's strain not, as well on the body did you find?
It's down to belief, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's a believe and achieve, and that's what Arnold's old saying, believe and
did
achieve.
Did you just stick to the same program, the same tools and techniques from the first one to the fifth?
I tell everybody, I tweet a little bit, but I tell everybody that once that'll come and ask me for advice. The most important thing about when you're asking a coach for advice, because there's any amounts of personal trainers nowadays who's never had that experience getting on stage, but they can get
everybody's
off
your, a coach. I think you can get a coach.
But they can offer your
hours.
Advice. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I'll say to people, I've done it a few times. I've done it with my son. You know, I've done it with other people. That if I'm keeping an eye on somebody, I'm in tune with what they're doing. You know what I mean? It's not just a I'm not looking at them flippantly and just giving them generic advice. I am actually in tune with what their body's doing because I've been there myself. And I know how things react because I've experienced it all. So I'll give you a for instance. A lad called Lucas Gabras was at the Universe 1 year when I was judging. He's from the Northwest, good competitor. And he'd getting up and I'd seen him and he got sixth in the tall class category. And he was a bit sore-headed about it. And he was under the illusion he was a lot better than what he was, I think. Anyway, I knew he could have been a lot better, a hell of a lot better, because I've seen him better. He's lost so much muscularity. So anyway, I thought, I'm going to give this lad a ring and give him a hand out, you know. So anyway, I rang him on the Monday after the Saturday. And I says, hey, Lucas, this is Eddie Elwood. And he didn't know who I was. I says, Eddie Elwood, I says, from North. I says, I've competed tall class, but I didn't tell him my pedigree. I'm not a person who does that. And I says, I've competed everywhere before. You know what I mean? I says, and if you want a hand out, I says, I'm willing to give you for advice if you want. So I've got a coach. And I said, I'm not trying to take away from any coach that you've got. I says, I was just offering some help because I'm a tall class competitor, and I thought I could pass some of my experience on to you. Well, thanks very much, but like, it was a thanks, but no thanks. The very next day, he must have Googled what I'd done. He rang us back the very next day within the 24-hour period. Anyway, it was my sportman the night. He rang us back in the morning the next day. He says, "Hi, champ." He says, can I come across and see you? I said, yeah, no problem. So he came across to me, Jim, from the northwest, about 3 or 4 hour journey. The minute he came in within, like, he says, I started asking him about what he'd been doing. He says, well, I was on I was on 100 grams of carbs a day the last 6 weeks, and that was dropped to 50. He was doing 2 hours cardio every day, walking. Anyway, he showed us his feet. He says, look at my toes. I said, that's not off walking. I said, it's off bad nutrition. Like his toenails were dropping off and stuff. He thought it was because he was doing that much cardio. I said, it's just bad nutrition. I said, what else? He said, I'm doing 580 grams of protein and 250 grams of fat. And I'm thinking, like, how's your body coping? I went, right. He says, and before you say anything, I'm carb intolerant. And I was like, yeah, I've heard this before. You know what I mean? You've got to accept it, though. You know what I mean? If you're not going to listen. I said, right, I'm not going to frighten you with it. I said, nobody's carb intolerant. I says, that's how we're made. We're made to eat energy foods. Mm-hmm. I says, our bodies rely on energy, keep our metabolism's going. I said, but I'm not going to take you down that route of eating lots of carbs. I'm going to start you off on a moderate intake. I'm going to change your calorific intake round first. So what do you mean? I says, right, your protein, mate. I says, way too much over the top. I says, 580. I says, you look more like 350. I said, so there's, what's that work out, about 230 over the top. I said, convert them into carbs, same calories. I said, so take 230 grams of protein off, I says, and convert them into carbs. So you've got 230, add to the 100 that you were already eating, or are you 50? So it's call it 330 you're on now, 330 carbs, but you're only on 350 protein, right? I says, you're 250 grams of fat. I said, you could do only 50 grams of fat, but there's twice as many calories in fat to carbs. So you could increase twice as many calories as twice as many grams of carbs. So you're talking another 400 grams of carbs on top. That's what I said. I'm looking at probably 700 grams of carbs for you. 750 or whatever. He says, no. I said, same calories. Just you're changing the calorific, you're changing the quantities of food round to suit. You're changing the macros, that's all you're doing. He went, right. I said, but I'm not going to frighten you with it. I said, I don't want you to eat 700 grams of carbs straight away. Let's start with three. And he was still shocked at three. I says, no, I'll just do three for a week and see where you go. So he rang us back after a week. He went, I've lost 2 pound, but I feel better. I said, yeah, your metabolism's kicking in. I says, now raise it another 100. So he did that for another week. And within, say, 5 or 6 weeks, he was up to the 700 grams of carbs because we just carried on increasing them, and he was just getting sharper and bigger.
Why are people scared of carbs?
Because of these crazy-ass as coaches, you know what I mean, who've never done anything, and they read something from a book and follow somebody else's logic, and it's just not logic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's...
For anybody that's maybe thinks cutting their carbs with no energy left and they think it's the way forward to lose weight, what advice would you give for them?
Right, the Atkins diet. People lose like 8 to 10 pound going on the Atkins diet within days, and they think those, I've lost 8 to 10 pound within a couple of days. Simple case of water manipulation. Every molecule of glycogen in your system holds onto 2 molecules of water. So say your system is carrying 1 kilo of glycogen, it's carrying another 2 kilo of water with that glycogen. If you go Atkins diet, you're going to burn all the glycogen off within 24 hours. So that water can't, there's nothing to hold the water, so the water goes with it. So within 24 hours, you can lose 6 pound. Because the glycogen's gone, the water's got to go away. It's 6 or 7 pound you can lose within 24 hours. Then you might create a bit of fat burning because your body's requiring the calories, so it starts moving into burning the fat. So that'll last for a few more days, but then your body realises there's nothing there. So it slows up. The metabolism slows back down. So yeah, you can lose 8, 10 pound in a week, and feel great because you have psychologically, but then your metabolism's slow and you can't really eat a lot. You know what I mean? You're eating protein and fats to keep yourself going. Mm. Our bodies are not made like that. They've never been made like that. You need to keep a balanced diet. Mm.
So when you won the fifth Mr. Universe, how did your life change? Did it start to change? Did you start getting more recognition? More people wanted to work with you?
I wasn't I kept myself to myself. It was a personal thing I did.
Why is that?
Because I never chased any fame. This was just personal goals I was setting myself to achieve. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't chasing sponsorships or fame or anything like that. It basically went from there to the Doors. You know what I mean? I started doing door security and I was getting recognition. So people was, and because I was handy as well, people would say, would you run your door for me? And I'd start taking more work on that side, on the security. So, but nothing within the actual sporting field, no.
What kind of cycles were you doing? What kind of juice gear was it? Every
a lot of people would stay constantly on. I can't believe how they can just continuously do that. I mean, it's not about the gear. The secret is the nutrition.
Because you've still kept your size. Do you take anything now?
I don't even train.
Do you not?
No, so but how I've did got you torn keep... muscles and stuff now, so I don't train because
so how do you
I've
keep
your
size? Because you see people maybe took gear 10 years ago and when they came off, they just look fucking like...
I'm carrying a lot of fat now, say a lot of biscuits. Is
but how do you... How do some people keep size and other people just... It just goes...
I think synthetic size is built quite quickly with water retention. Mm-hmm. And they rely on drugs when they've built it that quickly. They rely on drugs to hold it there. Mine was done with many years of solid, heavy training. And that's why I was always a strong bodybuilder. And I always wanted to do strongman, but I didn't want to do it first. So that was me. I evolved from bodybuilder to strongman, not the other way around, because I did not want to compete strongman because of the risk of injury. If strongman's quite heavy, I wouldn't be able to come back to the bodybuilding. But I could do it the other way. If I get injured at strongman, then I just retire at strongman.
So what stuff would you take in a cycle? By a lot? You see the bigger men, would they be taking more gear or would just be training?
Some
hard?
Did.
How does it work?
Some did, but that's not the magic formula. Like you say, the magic formula is the nutrition. It's how you eat, how your life is, how you're actually... how you keep your pattern of your life together, like your rest, your sleep, your training, your nutrition, everything has to be in a formula, you know, all has to go together, otherwise it just doesn't work. You can't have like sleep pattern missing, you can't have like the nutrition missing. It's like putting a key in a lock, and that lock will not turn if there's a tooth missing off the key, you know, and you've got to have everything in order and it's got to be that disciplined. If you're lacking even a little bit of discipline, you're not going to make it.
Mm. Was there a lot of jealousy towards you after winning five?
No. I think a lot of people realised the quality I was competing with and what I was doing to maintain it. Mm. I mean, I would just do that one show every year. You know, I would just like think, after I'd won it the first time, I'd maybe do another show that might add a little bit of prize money, but there wasn't a lot of prize money there, so I used to just set myself, because I had a job. I had the security business, which kept me going. So I trained like a professional, even though I was making professional money.
Yeah.
That's basically all I did. I lived to train.
Why did you not go for the sixth?
Because nobody had done five. The money wasn't there for six, and I still wanted to do strongman before I got too old.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? For muscle tears and all that shit?
The strongman, I was strong as bull. I was doing crazy weights in the gym, but I didn't realise the strongman... Because when I went to my first Britain's Strongest Man, I did it without very little training. So I went from the October competing to doing strongman in the March. And my body wasn't really ready because I hadn't used much equipment. And you need to practice on the equipment, like lifting stones and stuff like that. Mm. It's not just gym training. You can be strong as a bull in the gym, but if you've never picked a stone up before, you're not just going to do it on the day. So there is techniques and stuff you need to learn. Pulling a truck, you're not going to pull a truck on the day if you've never pulled one before. Mm-hmm. You need the right shoes, you know, you need to get low enough. There's a lot of technique behind a lot of it, so you need to get to somewhere where you can use that type of equipment.
Yeah.
And although I had got somewhere to use the equipment, I hadn't practiced with everything, so I was raw, you know what I mean? I was going into it with just raw strength. So the first couple of events, I win outright, and like they're all raving, like thinking I'm going to win this competition, like nobody's business. Me third event, I think I got fourth in, it was a shield carry, but it hurt my arms because it was hard to get me, because I was that deep with chest, to get my arms right around. It was a steel Africa stone or whatever it was. And to get my arms right round it, it was digging in, it was that thick. You haven't a basic, if you can't get your fingers, you're holding like that, it's digging in there on the lower part, the bicep. And because there wasn't much fat on my arms, it was like compressing a hose pipe, I suppose. It was flattening it. So I can just imagine like the pressure on my tendons. Now looking back is why my arm tore on doing the stones on the next event, because they were still in like a damaged position.
You know? How hard is it to, what's the training like from being bodybuilder to then going to strongman? Is it totally night
for
and
me,
day?
For me, it is night and day. For me, it was easy to do strongman.
Why is that?
Because I could eat what I wanted. I wasn't watching my food. I could eat what I wanted and I still maintained decent shape. But to do the strongman, I was always used to training heavy anyway. It was a new challenge because I was doing things differently. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit of a pleasure. Especially because I was quite good at most of it, you know.
The strongman's massive now, so I'm good friends with the Stoltman brothers. Yeah, yeah. Martin Scott and Big
absolutely,
Tom and his brother and his just two great guys. And
absolutely.
28 fucking stone.
Over the moon for them too.
28 stone. Yeah, just two good guys. Yeah. It's more endurance now, they says. It's not just a case of picking up stones, man.
Like, they've all got to train, they've all got to get athletically fit now, you know.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Yeah, it was good crack. Mm-hmm. Well, there was a story where after I tore my bicep at Britain's Strongest Man this first year, I went to a place called, I was invited 6 weeks later, and that's how quickly I competed after the torn bicep. I went to Winnipeg in Canada, and I was thinking, my arm's still a bit buggered, but I'll go. I was part of a British team. There were six international teams there, so there was 36 competitors. And all the guys who placed top six at Britain's Strongest Man. So I was like, I wasn't the winner, So there was me, Bill Pittick, I forget who else was there. There was a few top names there. But me and Bill Pittick, we treaded quite relaxed. And it was in a nightclub, in this big nightclub in Winnipeg in Canada. And there was some good, there was Ukraine, Russian, Czech teams, Dutch team, English team, USA, you know what I mean? And we thought like, just relax, we're just here for a good time. So anyway, me and Bill got drunk in the nightclub every night, stayed there till 4 o'clock, come out rolling. And that's not me. Honestly, it's not me. I'm not a drinker, but we came out rolling every night to start competing at 9 o'clock in the morning. Next day we saw heads and we were winning everything. But I can only say it was down to being so relaxed, you know?
Yeah. A lot of pressure gets put on you for those competitions.
I suppose, yeah. Strongman's different than bodybuilding. You get on stage and you just, but strongman, you're competing against other men. Like, it's a race to hoot and do it first. Or,
yeah, your son's competing now, is that correct?
Yeah, Ethan.
How does he feel then? Is that a lot of pressure on him, knowing who his old boy was?
No, because he's just too relaxed. But the first year he competed, he was only, 19 himself, and he came to me and he'd never competed before. He was just like, but I'd been training as a boxer, so, but he'd never really done any training. He'd done a bit of rugby at school and for the local rugby club, but he was very soft.
Did you ever try and push him into it at an early age?
No, I've never pushed anybody to do anything. It's up to them to make their own mind up. I push them towards a few things. The mum took them to football, they played rugby, so they can make their own mind up, but I didn't want to push them into something that was going to really contain them, because bodybuilding does contain you, like I said. You just like, it holds you down. If you get the bug, it'll hold you down. So it was his choice. He came to see us after he'd been he'd booked a holiday to go to Ibiza for September, and he said it was will you write as a diet try and get me abs through? And I'm looking at him thinking, you're too soft, you'll not get abs through. You'll not get abs through for September, what I mean. But he stuck to his diet and he did get some sort of shape and like leaned himself up. It wasn't like blocks of abs or anything, but he leaned himself up and he looked all right. Came back from Ibiza, and this is like, again, October time. than the area competitions in the May. He says to us, do you think I could get ready for the journey in North Britain? And I was like, how would you tell your son no? You know what I mean? And I honestly didn't think he would do it, honestly. But I didn't tell him that. I just said to him, right, I'll tell you what we'll do with you. We'll give you a diet to stick to it at Christmas. If I see some improvement, I see some sacrifice, then we'll wait after Christmas, then we'll decide after Christmas. Give him his due. He put everything into it. He got ready for the area final. I'm going to show you some pictures, actually.
Yeah,
when you finish. I'll show you some pictures when we finish.
You can put them up on the screen.
And it was 10 months, actually, from him asking us to getting on stage. You won't believe the change. Mm. I'll you can put them on the screen at the end. Yeah. 10-month transformation from a soft kid to a ripped athlete. You know what I mean? And he got second at the area competition. Mm. It was 4 weeks to the final after that. I put another £10 on him for the final and in better condition. And he got second at the... I said, you get second or third at the final.
Do you see a lot of yourself in your son? That mentality, I can't do it.
No, he hasn't got the same mentality because he likes to party. You know what I mean? I wasn't that way inclined. You know, like when I was going out with my friends, well, they weren't friends, they were colleagues. When I was getting ready for competitions and stuff, and they were all wanting to like, oh, we'll have a drink, we'll this, we'll that. Let's go and do this, let's go. I was like, no, it's time for me to go home. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew I had training in the morning and that's the way I was.
Yeah.
I just stuck with it, you know.
When was the last time you competed, Eddie?
Strongman was 2008.
Was it?
Which was a wild card, which I finished Strongman career in 2005, actually, and did nothing for 3 years, but gym training. And I got invited to do Britain's Strongest Man in 2008 with a wild card. I'm not into wild cards. I like to earn my place. Mm-hmm. I always used to argue about wild cards, you know, and anyway, there were shorter competitors, Britain's Strongest Man, and just because I'd been a character in the past, they wouldn't give you a wild card. I said, I've only got 3 weeks to train. You know what I mean? So I'd said to them, do you mind giving us a couple of weeks to see if I can get myself pulled round somewhere? 2 weeks wasn't long enough. Mm-hmm. And they went, yeah, you know, a couple of weeks. So I went down to Darren Sadler's yard. Darren now runs all the strongman. He looks after the likes of the Saltmans and everything. You know, it's like he looks after the whole Giants Live thing. It's his baby, him and Colin, who does all the commentating. So I went down to his yard and we did some stones, some light stuff, and I pulled me lad doing the stones. I thought, I'm going to leave that. I can't do it again. Otherwise, I'm going to tear myself to bits before the final. So I just rely on my strength and remembering what I did when I... Mm-hmm. So I'd done a lot of gym training for it and I ended up still getting into the final of Britain's Strongest Man and placing eighth, I think I was. Mm-hmm. And I did it thinking like... If I can just do something after 3 weeks training, maybe next year I'll come back after a full year's training.
Yeah.
But I just...
Has it become tiresome?
It was tiresome. I just thought, you know something, I'm not getting any younger and these lads are all getting stronger. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I'm putting my body... It's not worth it. I'm not an egotistic person. I don't do it for ego.
How much sacrifice do you need to put in, Eddie, when you're doing competing for Mr. Universe or Strongman? There's a lot of sacrifice.
Both of them, there's a lot of sacrifice, yeah. And like... If you've got partners, they're going to suffer because you've got to be one track minded. You can't, you've got, your time's your own and nobody else's, and it does cause a lot of rifts in.
Yeah. What happened then once you stopped everything? Where did your life go then?
I just stopped Strongman and I just kept on with the gym and everything.
And all the stuff that was in the papers there, you were fighting to keep your gym open through lockdown.
So what happened there was, in the first lockdown, I lost a member to suicide. And another lad had got sectioned. And I knew nobody who'd suffered any sort of fatality from COVID. And I'm not saying that COVID doesn't exist. What I'm saying about COVID, and even now, I want to say what COVID's all about. The elderly, those who are weak with other conditions, they're the ones that's taken out. It's not taking out healthy people, you know? And that's the reality of it. But the young and those who've got work and everything else have all suffered for that. And they're the ones who are getting guilt-tripped into getting vaccinations to save the elderly who are at the end of life. And I just think, I think there's a narrative, there's an agenda behind it. And it's, as much as I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist, it's not conspiracy because I've researched the facts. There's depopulation going on. And it's no different what the Nazis doing in the Second World War. They're getting rid of the strain on society and the weak. You know, basically the elderly that they've took out, which I believe they've taken them out really with whatever it is, you know what I mean? They've gone early. I mean, still, the majority of people that have died of it are over 80. When the end of life in the UK, like life expectancy in the UK, the average age is only 81.8. The average age of dying of COVID is 82.3. So I'll admit they've died over the average age. So there should be classes dying of old age. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? The majority of people should be. Yeah. Because you've got to wear out sometime. If you die of cancer, heart failure, whatever, your body's at its end after end of life expectancy. Mm-hmm. And that's what I believe. And I have, like I say, I have sympathy for all death. But what I found out off the ONS own website, Office of National Statistics, is that those over 40, under 45, there was three times more suicides to COVID death in under 45 years of age. And the suicide death rate, because it would have already been suicides, was up 50%. That's not proportional. And I think the whole thing's been handled wrong. Kids at the same time, in the first wave, there was only four kids who died under 14. Yet we shut all the schools, we shut all the colleges, all the universities. There was only 10 under 20. Total, and most of them have had underlying conditions, but we shut all the colleges, all the universities. They're the ones that suffered. I had a nephew who was frightened to go out the house, a nine-year-old nephew, frightened to go out the house because he was thought he'd die of COVID. There was no risk of him dying of COVID. He was a healthy kid. So towards the end of the first lockdown, I went and took him out for a day, and his mum says, I'm over the moon, you're taking him out. She says, he's never been out all through this COVID malarkey. She says he's frightened to go out in case he catches COVID. So I took him out, but I'd seen he'd put so much weight on. He'd gone from a healthy, agile kid to this beefed up kid, you know, who'd just been sat in the house playing video games all summer. I took him out. He had a great day. I says, do you want to come out again tomorrow? And he was like, we were only at the beach. He said, oh yeah, I'll come out tomorrow. I says, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go to Tweddle Farm tomorrow because the farm had just opened back up. It's like a petting farm. And his face changed. And I thought, what's the matter with him? Something matter on him? What's up? Something bothering him? So I just left it to the end of the day. I says, are you still all right to go out tomorrow? He went, well, maybe not. I don't really want to go to Tweddle because there's pigs there and I might get the swine flu, isn't there? And I was like, what's this doing to our children? You know what I mean? And we're going to suffer these effects for many years to come.
When did you start looking into it then fully, like statistics? And
after we lost that guy to suicide, mm-hmm. I started researching it last August. I formed a group called MAD, which is Make a Difference. And it wasn't so I could open all businesses. It was more so to help those with mental health problems. Forming a group like that brought a lot of people together who do have mental health problems. And even just meeting once a week, it was alleviating a lot of problems that they had because they could talk to somebody with similar problems and we discussed them with each group. And we hugged, we shook hands, we went on walks together. The group grew and grew and grew. And then the police came and infiltrated when they dropped the no more than two together. You know, you can't get, no, sorry, it was groups of six. But I was informing the council and I was informing the police what I was doing. I was saying, I have the right to assemble. Under the United Nations laws, everybody has the right to protest or assemble. I said, and you can't discriminate against it. I said, and Christoph Heinz from the United Nations is a United Nations expert on human rights, had said that COVID-19 can't be used as an excuse to calm down on your fundamental rights. I said, so this is what we're doing. And they didn't like it, but they still tried to push the English legislation. So I was calling the police ignorant for doing it. I says, I'll challenge it in court. You know what I mean? So after I started doing that and the police tried to infiltrate, I thought, nah, I can do this. So when I found all that information, I started digging deeper for more information. I got the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There's 30 rights, 30 articles in the rights. The right to travel, the right of assembly, the right of free speech, all the rights that would support a peaceful, a right to protest, peaceful protest. So I thought, no. And also the United Nations said in the article that you could, protesters, and it was during the time of racial discrimination for BLM to hit the streets, protesters could wear masks or hoods, and governments and police couldn't collect personal data from them. I thought, well, that's another one for us. We can use that. Everybody has the right to protest, indoors, outdoors, or online. I said, right, now, if there's another lockdown come, which I think there is, I'm opening my gym to protest indoors. So lockdown two came. I put a rope across the ramp to me business. The rope read, peaceful protest ongoing. No trespass. Any other business telephone number. So they couldn't come across that rope and so come to protest. In me windows, all the paraphernalia, no more suicides, articles and rights and everything were all paraphernalia in me window. I also had a big notice to read on the window, which was an A3. And it basically started to say, this business is not open for regular, this premise is not open for regular business. We are only open to peaceful protest. And I listed all the articles to how to peacefully protest and how we could do it and how it was, you know. So they had to read that on coming in. Once people came in, they were all strangers. The majority of them were all strangers. They'd come in, they'd say, I'd say, what are you here for? And they'd say, if they said they were here to train, I'd say, you better get your ass back outside and read that poster again. And some of them, not too bright, took three times. So they come in and they eventually say, I'm here to use my fundamental right to protest. I says, right, okay, there's a slip. Print your name there. You're here to fundamentally use your fundamental rights to peacefully protest. Sign. So I had everybody slip a paper to say they'd come to sign to peacefully protest. They'd ask if they could pay. I said, I can't take a payment because my business isn't open, but you're free to make a donation if you wish. So they made donations. And then people said, well, can we train? I said, that's entirely up to you. How you want to protest is entirely up to you. So when the police came, eventually the police did come, but I'd warned the police what I was doing and I told the council what I was doing. And because I wasn't open for regular business, I wasn't open all day long to my business hours. I was only open select hours. Mm. So I would open 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours on the night. So I wasn't open for regular business. I was only open to protest. So this is once the police came in and I saw them, I wasn't watching all the time. I was stood behind reception. And anyway, the police came in this day and I said, excuse me, what are you doing? And they went, yeah, breaking COVID rules. I said, out. And the moon walked back out the door because we're on private property. Mm-hmm. I own the whole building. And I go outside and I said, well, are you breaking COVID rules? I said, no, I'm not peacefully protesting. I said, under United Nations laws, I have the right to protest and you can't do nothing about it. No, well, not under English legislation. I says, okay, then I'm going to use an analogy here. England's strongest man, world's strongest man, which is more superior, you know what I mean? So you've got English legislation, now you've got United Nations legislation. I says, the UK is a member of the United Nations, 173 countries ratified the United Nations Covenant. I says, in the United Nations, England, UK are one of the biggest funders. I says, they've got to abide by United Nations laws. I said, so I'll take my chance in court with United Nations laws. And they were like, well, that's not right. There's people training. I said, define protest. And they were stumped. Well, I says, in the dictionary, protest says an action or statement in objection of. The action or statement's training, and we're objecting about gyms being closed. Peaceful, there was no aggro. It's a peaceful protest. And they were stumped, you know. One copper said it was, well, that's not right. Just because I've got a car doesn't mean I can drive it at 80 mile an hour. I went, nah. I says, that's breaking the law. Mm-hmm. Training isn't. And I walked back inside and left him scratching his head, you know. Mm-hmm. And then another day they came and they were trying to take pictures on the outside of me ramp, but they were still on my land. So I went outside and I'd seen these two before. And I says, can I ask you what we're doing? Yeah, we're police. I said, I know you're police. I says, see that bungalow over there? He says, yeah. I says, you see that bungalow over there? He says, yeah. I says, draw an imaginary line across there. He says, yeah. I says, get back the other side of it. I says, this is my property, you're trespassing.
Mm-hmm. What did they do?
They did.
When did they shut you down though? And how?
So I'd boxed this off for weeks. Mm-hmm. And even to the point where the infiltrator tried to stop people, tried to find people coming out the building, and I stood my ground with them. Me on my own, nobody else. Mm-hmm. people panicked in the gym. They'd come from all over and they were like, oh, Eddie, the police are there. Said, don't worry about us. I'll go out in the front and I said, you're not at liberty to collect any details, so off, do one. No, Mr. Elwood, you don't know what you're doing. I said, I don't know what I'm doing. I says, you're not at liberty to collect any details of anybody leaving a peaceful protest. Now do one. You know what I mean? So I was saying to people inside, leave, get in your vehicles, don't take any notice to the police. You don't have to give the police any details. You give them your details, they're going to give you a fine. But if you don't give them your details, you'll be on your way. I said, if they've got anything on you, they would arrest you. And I'm telling you, you'll not get arrested, but they will fine you if you give them details. So they'll go out. So some of the lads were like, okay. So I'd go out and stand on the ramp and I'd say, right, just get in your car, carry on driving, keep carrying on driving out the gate and away home. And I would stand there shouting them as the police were knocking on the windows, telling them to stop, you know what I mean? But they never got arrested. Anyway, I'd gone inside and some of the women were a bit anxious. So I'd say to the women, right, I know you're a bit anxious and I'm not expecting you to front the police because there was four coppers outside my gates and there was two, there was a chief and a female officer inside trying to collect information on them. So anyway, the women, I said to them, look, I'm not expecting you to leave by the front door. I don't expect you to front it. So if you want, you can leave by the fire exit. I'll shut the doors. I'll leave. You can leave by the fire exit when I've gone. Just shut the fire exit behind you. Right, do you not mind? I said, no, I don't mind. So anyway, a few more lads are leaving in the meantime. They've gone. One lad told us the next day, he says to us, do you mind if I leave my van? He says, not in Sherwood. I says, no. So he left his van in the car park and walked. So I'm shouting at him, do not give them. So there's two coppers on his tail following him. But didn't. I said, just don't say anything to them. Just carry on walking. Don't even have to talk to them. I said, if they go out on you, they'll arrest you there. And then just carry on walking. He got about 1,000 yards all the way around to a road junction across the road. And the police were hammering, like aggravating him all the way around, saying, we're going to arrest you if you don't stop. He said, I got the junction. I was thinking, like, shall I take a step across the road? He says, and I'd start walking across the road. And they'll just shout, if you come back, we'll arrest you.
Is that not harassment, though?
It's harassment. So I was telling them that they were harassing people. So as I came, as he told me that the next day, I said, well, I showed you they had nothing on you because they couldn't arrest you. Mm-hmm. I said, so as he'd gone, so then there was other lads left and then the women went, boof, boof, the chest. No, Eddie, we're going by the front too. I thought, good on you. You know what I mean? So one of the women went out and said, her car was quite close. I said, just get in your car and just drive out the gates. Do not take any notice of them officers. Mr. Elwood, you're interfering with police business. I said, you've gotten out and you can't do it. I said, just get in your car, keep on driving. And she's driving out the gates, which is about probably 50 metres away from your main door, the gates. And she gets down to the gate and she's half out the gate, half on the road. And a copper jumped in the road and went, stop! And I thought, so I took off down the road. I got to the bottom of the road. By the time I'd gotten there, a window was down and he had her crying. So I jumps in the road. I went, right. I says, go on, get on your way, Flower, get on your way. And he was saying, Mr. Elwood, under the Road Traffic Act. I says, what Road Traffic Act? I says, she's not doing no, she hasn't broke any laws. She's driving a car on a main road. I says, go on, get on your way. She's got, so she's up, halfway up the road, he shouts, I've got your number. And I turned to the four of them that were there and I said, is this what our police have turned into? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? A pack of fannies. Mm-hmm. No need to swear, Mr. Elwood. I says, fannies not swearing. And I walked back in. So anyway, she didn't get fined. There's still not any fines off that day, and they were harassing the life out of people in my car park that day. It eventually came to a culmination. I'd had police come in. I bought myself a body cam to record everything. Sorry. I bought myself a body cam to record everything, and it was a proper police-like type quality, you know, so I had a big red laser on. So on the night time through the winter, I was going outside. And I was, if there was a cop, one day my son was in training, which he was allowed to because he was an elite athlete. He could train with his girlfriend. Him and his girlfriend in a private gym wasn't breaking any rules. So he was in. He says, Dad, he says, there's a police van parked right outside the gate. So if you imagine my gates are there, the double roads run down here. The police van was there. That was my gates. Mm-hmm. So he was there to intimidate people driving in. You know, you could see what he was there for. I says, all right, son. I says, you just lock up. I says, come home. I says, I'm on my way down. This was middle of lockdown three. So I'd get through all lockdown two.
No fines yet?
No fines. Getting through all lockdown two, into lockdown, halfway into lockdown three. So I says, all right, I'm coming down, and I'm confident now because I've done it that many days now, you know. So I drives down through the street. He's still there. I drives in there, up to the gym, up the ramp, opens the door, lights on, music blasting. I went and put my body cam on, and I pointed the red laser through his window, and it was refracting like a little red glittering disco ball in his cab. And he must have thought, oh, God. Anyway, he'd lasted about 10 minutes, put his light on and he went. You know, it's as if he was being called to somewhere. And then a couple of days later, I had another cop car come in and they just sat in a parking bay. So I put me laser on again, went outside and it blasted through his window. And he got, and you could see he was sick. And he got out of his car and he come wandering over. He went, Eddie, man. He says, we get it. He says, we get it. I says, I know, but you're taking orders that you don't really believe in, just like the Nazis did in the Second World War. You know, you can't have an excuse to obey orders that are not really right. You know what I mean? Morally right. You know, they're wrong. So anyway, he says, we get it. So anyway, they went. And then a week before I was done, and there's no way that my gym wasn't centre of attention or centre board in the police station at the start of every shift. You know what I mean? There would have been like, we've still got this ongoing. It was going tonight. You know what I mean? It's got to have been. There's no way that wasn't like, oh, we've still got Elwood's gym or Extreme Fitness. There's no way it would have been just discussed. And every cop must have known about it because how I had that much interaction with it. So this night, I'm in the gym and one of the lads on the calf machine's looking out the doors. He said, he's a policewoman just pulled up in a car there. And I was like, eh? So I thought, well, everybody knows what's going on here. Mm. You know what I mean? I was on a main dual carriageway on the way into town, all the lights upstairs blazing like Blackpool. So I wasn't hiding anything. The council and the police knew exactly. I'd emailed them all. So I was thinking, what's she doing here? You know what I mean? So I went outside and she was, as I was getting close to her, I thought, I'm not even going to let her get to the ramp where the rope is. I got under the ramp, started walking towards her. So as I'm getting towards her, she's just putting a mask on. She went, get back. I says, get back. I says, you get back, you're in my yard. Anyway, she looked at his attitude. And all I can think of is, she's probably thought, I'll show you, lads. She's been like, she's took it on as a challenge because she'd come by herself. And what makes it more realistic that way would be, she'd come by herself, she had attitude straight away. I think she was trying to work us to get it, to get me to rise. So then it would become a non-peaceful protest. And then they'd have room to be able to arrest us. So I was too long in the tooth for that. Mm-hmm. So I was like, so I went to see her and I'd say like, I says, listen, I'm abiding by United Nations laws. I'm this and that, you know, I try to explain it all again. I said, I've even got the laws inside. If you want us to show you, I don't need to see the laws. I know my laws. I said, I'll go and get them for you. Just so she was aware that I knew what I was doing. And she should be really working for me under oath. I had studied all the police oaths and everything, what they should be stand for. They should be apolitical, shouldn't be working for the government, should be working for the public. They should be protecting our fundamental rights, you know, as civilians. They work for us as civilians. So I went in, got the laws, brought them out, went, here, I've got them laws. She went, I don't need to see them. I says, that's ignorance. That. She went, I'm ignorant. I says, yeah, you're ignorant. You know, she wouldn't read them. So then I went back outside to try and talk to her. She gives us a bit of, she went, come here, I'm going to find you. I says, you ain't like. And she went, aren't I? I says, no, you're not. And then I got under me rope and I says, you cross that and I'm going to find you. And she went, oh. I says, I mean, you go across. I had fine books even wrote up, right? There was no way they could stand anywhere. It was just to give them a bit of harassment back. So if they were going across my barrier, you're going to get a fine back. So then she got on a radio. I went inside and I just stood inside and she was on a radio. And within 5 minutes of her speaking on it, because I went inside thinking, no, she can't do now. She's not going to do now. Within 5 minutes, three vans came flying at the car park, four police cars outside the gate. And I was like, oh, wow. I sat down myself straight away. I thought, they must have someone on us. What have they got on us? What have I missed? You know what I mean? What have I missed? Anyway, So I went outside again and I'm looking and one of the cops is getting out of the vans and she's convening in the centre of the car park with all of them. One of the cops, she says, can I have a word, please? So he came walking over. I says, what's the problem here, officer? I says, there's no aggro here. He says, I know, and we're not allowed, we can't cross your barrier either. And I was thinking, right, that's something. What have they come flying in for? And within 5 minutes, I've worked the clubs in the town for many years. when the town was at its busiest. I had the majority of the main clubs in the town. I was 80 yards from a police station. If I ever wanted assistance, it used to take them 40 minutes to get there. You know what I mean? Yeah. For the clubs, they were there within 5 minutes to tackle me with that much force. You know what I mean?
Planned.
It was planned. They were waiting at the end of the street. And I think she'd been sent to get me to rise, and then they would come in. And as this couple of wide talked to was walking down to see what they were talking about in the group, she'd already left the group and was walking back, and as she was passing, I heard her say, apparently it's been dealt with. You know what I mean? And they all had to go. Within 2 days, my son was in the premise. Again, they came when I wasn't there because I would front everything. They came when my son was in and served him with a closure notice under an antisocial behaviour order. So I got that on 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So he brought it home and gives it at 5 o'clock. I still went down that night, but I had to close because the coppers turned up. The coppers can come in on a closure notice because they've already been given the authority off the courts. And I didn't know anything about it, but you've got 48 hours. It's an emergency notice. I asked to go to court within 48 hours to shoot somewhere. And I'm thinking, like, what's the crack? Like, obviously, I can't get a solicitor that day. I can get a solicitor the following day. So I got a solicitor the following. I rang a solicitor the following day, but I'm at court at 10 o'clock the day after in the morning. So he says to us, I'm at court all day. I'll give you a ring back tonight. And I'm thinking, well, that's a bit late. You don't even know where I'm being. You know what I mean? So anyway, he rings us back at 9 o'clock that night. All right, Eddie, I'll see you at 10 a.m. in the morning. I'm thinking, well, you don't know anything. How am I going to fight this? So I went to court the next day and he says, right, what have you got? And I showed him. I says, and I've been peacefully protesting. This is how I've been doing it. And this, I'd spent all night putting it all in order. All the emails I'd sent the council, and I'd sent them lengthy emails, like they were like five pages long. Police, they'd all had emails of us. He said, I'll just go and see what they're actually pushing for. He says, because I can't understand this, the ASBO, why they're pushing an ASBO. So he came back, he says, you're getting the ASBO, whatever. He says, that's what's been decided. But he says, I can't understand why they're pushing. But he says, you're fucked anyway. I says, how was that like? He says, well, because I've got people training in your gym on camera. I said, but how's that? I says, I've never denied that. I says, not once have I denied that. I says, you know, it's that's a protest still. Well, how you can't train on it. I says, a protest is an action in objection of. And peaceful, I explain it to him. Oh, I can't say that. Then he says, but I'll if you want us to object, I'll object for you. I'm thinking, well, you're not confident. You know what I mean? So immediately I knew he says, but if you want to push it, it's English law, not get discussed in English. United Nations laws won't be discussed in English law courts. It'll get pushed to Crown Court. And Crown Court's also an English court. He says, and that won't get discussed there. So it'll get pushed to a Supreme Court, National European Court. He says, you're going to spend 100 grand. So he put us down. He frightened the life out of us. I wish I'd known more what I know now. I'd have challenged it myself. Mm-hmm. So anyway, we decided to accept the closure notice with respect that if gyms opened before my closure notice did, that they would allow that closure notice to lift, because otherwise I'd lose a lot of business. Because the closure notice was to middle May and lockdown lifted on 12th of April for gyms. So they said yes to that. So I said, well, I'll work under the radar, you know, and find out what I can do. So at the minute, I've got some interest with working for them, with the lawyers from Liberty, which are all on the same page as us at the moment. Yeah. These are independent lawyers that don't believe in what's going on and want to fight what's going on. And I've done a lot of studying on the ASBO. I read right through the ASBO and the very last article or sentence in an ASBO, because ASBO can be used for crack houses, drunk and disorderly, playing music too loud, riding motorbikes up and down the street. They're all reasons for an ASBO. But at the end of the ASBO description, it says an ASBO can't be used in conjunction with human rights. So I was protesting, which is a human right. So I can't say how that closes.
Have you ever been fined yet? No.
No.
No. Is that everything dealt with now?
It's dealt with, but I want to push it further.
What do you think with the rise in between COVID deaths and suicide deaths?
Well, that was the thing. Another thing, like I said, there was from the COVID deaths under 45, There was only 545 cases in the first lockdown, which again, like I say, with us losing a friend to suicide, I studied all this, and then to find out there was three times more suicides than COVID deaths in those under 45 in the first lockdown. That's what I just started doing this for. I was thinking, this is not proportional. Mm-hmm. It's not right. It's not what, you know, there's a lot more people dying because they can't manage the mental health.
Why was there some gyms getting fined 10, 20, 30 grand?
Because they were using Article 61, which is common law, which can stand.
What's Article 61?
It's a right to rebellion. And gym owners were using that and were told what to say. But if you haven't got it up here, you're going to get fined. Because they were dishing fines out like they were...
Yeah,
you know,
seen some kids in Liverpool, Manchester. Yeah. They were like padlocks on the door, but the coppers were just coming right through and jailing them.
So I knew I had something. Because that day I told you about them being in my car park and me getting people out, and I had to rush down to... And I was on the main road... Mm-hmm. Why didn't the rest of me as the gym owner?
Why was everybody not jumping on that then?
You know what I mean?
People not messaging you?
I had people messages and I tried to guide them through it. I told them they had to come and see what I was doing to actually walk through it, mm-hmm. to get confidence in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if they all stood on and done what I done, they'd still probably end up with the closure notices at the end of it, but they'd be getting all that time without hassle if they'd have stood on and researched it. The only thing is, you did need to research it. You can't just have, it's just like the Article 61. If you don't know what you're talking about, they're going to tie you in knots. Like, police came to my mum's gym and I only had to happened to turn up one day, and I boxed it off because I knew everything. My parents were doing everything, they were mirroring everything I was doing. It was my parents' gym, but it was my brother that was doing it. I'd give him the notices for the window. I made sure that he said what they had to say, but they were a different council to me. Durham Council, Hartlepool Council, different council. So their environmental health officer was a bastard.
Yeah.
He was a proper Jobsworth.
Where do you go now with it, Eddie?
So now I want to work with the Lawyers for Liberty, and I want to create a... Independent Gym Alliance. And at the protests at the weekend just gone in London, I met up with Dorian Yates. Dorian's well awake, and I'm hoping that he's going to put his name behind the Independent Gym Alliance to try and get gyms open if there's any more lockdowns. And my idea is Nathan Diasher, who was also pushed heavily through the lockdowns for keeping his gym open, and a lad called Damien from Rip Gym, who's from Liverpool also, we're all going to pull together and try, and we want a crowd justice page where we can raise funds for lawyers and legals to get it up and running and get a plan for gyms to open legally. And then we want to try and raise, the Independent Gym Alliance, we want to do it with a membership fee, so gyms can maybe pay £50, members of gyms can maybe pay £10. So if there's any more future lockdowns, they can attend them quite freely and feel comfortable of not being fined. And if they do get fines, our legal team will take it all under one umbrella.
Yeah. For anybody watching, Eddie, that's maybe battling with mental health, how important is exercise key for them?
I don't think people realise how there's only those who don't train think it's a load of codswallop. If they don't train, they're just watching BBC TV all the time, then they're in one frame of mind. They don't understand how beneficial training or exercise or anything, be it a member of any club. They're a member of a club for a reason, because they like to socialise with people. And just cutting that one aspect out of their lives causes big mental health strain. And I would say in gyms, 90% of people that attend gyms attend for the mental health, to have some sort of structure in their life, to meet up with people, have a bit of banter, they don't necessarily just go to train. The ones, and I'll say this, even myself, we've all suffered some sort of mental health in our lifetime, you know what I mean? And I'll say that... 90%, like I said, only 10% go to get a physique, to compete, to be that person who wants to you know what I mean, to be that structure of a man or structure of a woman, have that perfect physique. But even them, they wear that physique as a shield protecting what's happening inside.
Yeah. Just before we finish up, Eddie, do you think there'll be another lockdown?
Yes.
Even though with the vaccines and all that put in place?
Yes.
Yeah?
And the reason I do is because the vaccines, we got through the first wave without vaccines. We didn't have to wear masks. BLM hit the streets in the hundreds of thousands. We had VE Day, and everybody, and we flattened the curve. The actual rise in infection rates started when they introduced the mandatory mask wearing and introduced vaccines, vaccine trials. All of a sudden, the infection rates started rising again. And yeah, it might sound a bit conspiracy theorist type thinking, but it's more suspicious. I'm just suspicious of what's going on. And the more they've done the vaccines, the more deaths seem to appear. So if all the elderly and all those who are at risk are vaccinated by now, why are we still worrying about other strains? The young, the healthy, those, you know, they should be allowed to live their lives normally. The vulnerable, the aged who are at risk, segregate themselves, let the rest of the country live,
yeah.
Keep the workforce going.
Eddie, for coming on today and telling your story, brother, I've thoroughly enjoyed that.
Thank you.
And look forward to what you see for the rest of the future, brother.
Right, you are.
Take care. Thank you.
You can also watch my podcast on my YouTube channel. The link is in the bio if you'd like to subscribe. You can follow me on my social media platforms to see who my next guest is. Follow me on Facebook at JamesEnglish11, Twitter, JamesEnglish0, Instagram, JamesEnglish2. You can also download these podcasts on iTunes or Spotify.